Eric, yeah, play that. Ari Melber and Wolf Blitzer and all these other cable shows. Go ahead. That, if that's your priority, do that. But if that's not your priority, call 212-209-2950. $50 a month to $600 a year. You're paying $250 for your cable bill to hear Barbara Starr and Jake Tapper, Lawrence O'Donnell, and Chris Hayes, and all these other people that work for the government. Work, support, thus, this station that doesn't work for the government. Yep. It's listener supported. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Thank you very much. I may be back next week. If not, I'll see you from the other side of the world.
Hey, this is Chaka Khan, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, a very special Women's History Month roundtable. On our last roundtable last week, we spoke to three women who were active with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Today, we speak with three women who are another generation after SNCC about their views on the impact of women in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the civil rights movement generally, women historic figures that have influenced them and their generation, and how they see the contributions of Black and other women of color in today's movements for change. Our guests are Jamie A. Swift, Executive Director, Creator, and Founder of Black Women Radicals, and Zalika Iborami, who is with the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement and Philadelphia Red Umbrella Alliance. Also, Nana Jumphy with Black Alliance for Just Immigration. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. 11 of the biggest banks in the country stepped in with a rescue package to prevent California-based First Republic Bank from becoming the third bank to fail in less than a week yesterday. While the rescue points to continued uncertainty in the banking sector, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen reassured members of the Senate Finance Committee the banking system remains stable. Eileen Alfandari has more.
San Francisco-based First Republic Bank received an emergency infusion of $30 billion in deposits from 11 major banks. J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citigroup, and Wells Fargo each agreed to put $5 billion in uninsured deposits into First Republic. Other major banks deposited smaller amounts of $1 to $2.5 billion. First Republic largely catered to wealthy clients, many of them billionaires, as did Silicon Valley Bank. In recent days, those large depositors began to withdraw their cash, risking a similar run as the one that crashed Silicon Valley Bank. Despite the deepening worry over the stability of the banking sector, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen told the Senate Finance Committee that depositors shouldn't worry.
I can reassure the members of the committee that our banking system is sound.
Republicans laid a big part of the blame for the bank's problems at the doorstep of President Biden. They said his policies caused high inflation, that the Federal Reserve has tried to tame through higher interest rates, which caused the problem at the banks. Massachusetts Democrat Elizabeth Warren noted there was support from both Democrats and Republicans to weaken the banking rules in 2018.
You know, over the last few days, we've heard a lot of Republicans say that this collapse wasn't their fault. It was the banking regulators who were asleep at the wheel. And believe me, I have questions for a lot of the banking regulators. But Congress handed Chair Powell the flamethrower that he aimed at the banking rules.
I'm Eileen Alfandari.
Parent company of the failed Silicon Valley Bank, SBV Financial Group, is filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. It failed last week. The Senate has taken a first step towards repealing two measures that give open-ended approval for military action in Iraq. The push to end that authority comes as the U.S. marks the 20th anniversary of the Iraq War, which was based on lies from the George W. Bush administration that Iraq was harboring weapons of mass destruction. According to the Cost of War Project out of Brown University, as many as 580,000 people were killed in Iraq and neighboring Syria. Senators voted 68 to 27, with 19 Republicans joining all present Democrats to move forward with repealing two Iraq war authorizations. Senate leader Democrat Chuck Schumer of New York and Republican Todd Young of Indiana both spoke in favor of the bill.
The United States, the nation of Iraq, and the entire world have changed dramatically since 2002. And it's time the laws on the books catch up with these changes. The Iraq war has itself been long over. This AUMF has outlived its purpose and we can no longer justify keeping it in effect.
I think many Americans will be surprised to learn that these authorizations for use of military force, or AUMFs, especially the 1991 Gulf War resolution, are still on the books. Zombie resolutions. They have fulfilled their purpose, and now they should be removed from our law.
U.S. troops remain in Iraq, now fighting the Islamic extremist group ISIS. The Cost of War Project estimates the ongoing cost will raise upwards of $2.9 trillion by 2050, noting the administration has requested nearly $400 million this month to cover efforts to counter ISIS. The Center for Constitutional Rights is calling for the U.S. to provide reparations for Iraqis harmed by, quote, the U.S.'s unlawful act of aggression and its cruel, senseless and baseless war for profit, it said. Peace groups will mark the 20th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq with actions across the country Saturday, including the nation's capital, where Professor Noam Chomsky, the Green Party's Jill Stein, and others will call for peace in Ukraine and for an end to NATO outside the White House at 1. Israeli army on Thursday killed four Palestinians and injured more than a dozen others in the West Bank city of Jenin. Rami Elmagari has more.
The Israeli newspaper Haaretz said that video showed an Israeli soldier shooting one Palestinian at point-blank range to ensure he was dead. Dr. Wissam Bakr is head of the Jenin government-run hospital.
In fact, it was a bloody day. We had four people martyred and more than 20 others wounded. One of those wounded is very critical, with an injury in the head and was transferred to the hospital. Others suffered injuries to the abdomen. They have undergone surgeries and are now stable. The rest of injuries were to the arms and legs. Some will need more surgical care.
It was the latest, bloodiest in a year-long wave of violence in the region. The Israeli military confirmed its troops were operating in the Jenin refugee camp, but provided no further details. The area is known as a stronghold of Palestinian militants, and Israel frequently conducts military raids in the area. For Pacifica Radio, I am Rami El-Mighari in Gaza.
I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And today we have a very special roundtable. Those of you who listened to our roundtable last week, you know that there were three women from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and also with friends of SNCC, telling us about their experiences. And today, we have three women, again, another generation after SNCC, about their views on the impact of women in the civil rights movement and as well as in SNCC, women historic figures that have influenced them and their generation, and how they see the contributions of Black and other women of color in today's movement for change. You won't want to miss that. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. I would now like to welcome to our roundtable Jamie A. Swift, who is the executive director, creator, and founder of Black Women Radicals, a Black feminist advocacy organization dedicated to uplifting and centering Black women and gender-expansive people's radical activism in Africa and the African diaspora. She is an assistant professor of Black politics at James Madison University. Jamie Swift, welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
Okay, I'd also like to welcome Zalika Ibarorimi. Zalika, I hope I got that right. She is a multidisciplinary artist, a PhD of African and African diaspora studies at the University of Texas at Austin. She is additionally an organizing member of the Malcolm X grassroots movement and the Philadelphia Red Umbrella Alliance. Zalika, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I'd also like to welcome Nana Jumphy. Some of you are, of course, familiar with Nana, as she sometimes hosts Sojourner Truth. And Nana is the executive director of Black Alliance for Just Immigration. She's an attorney. She's known as the people's attorney and has been in the trenches for decades now. Full disclosure, Nana also works with me at the Black Coalition Fighting Back Serial Murders. Nana, welcome.
Always great to be here, and so pleased to be with my sister and with joining you on the show.
Okay, thank you, Nana. So, Jamie, we'll start with you, and then all of you weigh in. Last week, I've actually been doing a series of Voices of Women in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It is Women's History Month. I will later in the show want to talk with you about movements of today and your thoughts on it. But Jamie, just to get your view on the significance of women, not only in SNCC, but in the civil rights movement, because a lot of what we hear about the civil rights movement are the men who were up front, who were the leadership. But we all know none of these movements would really have happened without the women. Jamie, let's start with you.
Agreed, wholeheartedly. I do think that oftentimes, and how I was socialized and also radicalized, was reading these texts and scholarship and literature about Black politics, revolutionary Black politics, but mainly it was always about cis heterosexual men at the vanguard. Like I said before, we know that, or like you said before, we know it's always Black women and gender expansive people who are leaders of these movements as well. Thinking about women of the civil rights movement, I was just talking with a Miss Barbara Smith, and how she of the Combahee River Collective, and how she speaks so highly of Fannie Lou Hamer, meeting Fannie Lou Hamer, and how that changed her life. And also, it's these many encounters that I've or interviews that I've had with different Black women leaders, such as Erica Huggins of the Black Panther Party, Denise Oliver Velez of the Young Lords Party and the Black Panther Party, and countless others who cite women like Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, Joyce Ladner, et cetera, as inspirations and as role models to their own activism.
Yeah, and of course, Fannie Lou Hamer, those of you not familiar with her work, if you go to the Pacifica Radio Archives website, we actually have some sound of Fannie Lou Hamer, including her describing how she was terribly beat and thrown in prison and beaten again while in prison just for registering Black people to vote. Fannie, the late great Fannie Lou Hamer. Okay, so Zalika, same question to you. Your thoughts?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you once again for having me here. You know, I'm thinking a lot about some of the civil rights figures who are particularly Black women and even gender expansive, as, you know, Jamie also stated, such as someone like Queen Mother Audley Moore. I think that she is someone, maybe because of just her affiliations, you know, with the Republic of New Africa and other spaces, and just the New African Independence Movement, she gets left out of conversation. So she's someone that I think of when I think of civil rights. But even some of those figures, such as Rosa Parks, who we know within the civil rights movement, but also some of the work that, you know, she did with someone such as, you know, Joanne Robinson, where we're thinking about those violent attacks against Black women, whether they were domestic workers, you know, whether they were waiting for a bus, and just the ways that they were sexually terrorized. And the important work that they did, and the important work that they did to assemble as a collective to organize, to figure out what was happening to these women, how to advocate and support these women as well. But, you know, when we hear this narrative, when we think of the Montgomery bus boycott, we see it as a more masculinist type of movement. But it was a lot of the feminized labor that took place that got us things such as, you know, the Montgomery bus boycott. So that's just a place that I would even start in thinking about civil rights.
Yeah, thank you, Zalika. And Nana, same question to you.
Absolutely. And what I would add is maybe sharing or spreading across our diaspora, right? And so when we think about leadership of various movements, including like the anti-apartheid movements, the anti-colonial movements, you know, we had women that were actually part of the military and fighting. And I think, you know, I'm a 90s baby, Gen X. So I think of how we would have posters up of these sisters with a baby in the back and a rifle in the front, you know? I think of Winnie Mandela and her leadership in the anti-apartheid movement and the effort to try to shape a new society there in South Africa. You had some, you know, folks like her who kind of broke through in terms of the vision or the of Black women in positions of leadership of major movements, or again, looking at colonial war. I think about in South America, Central America, the Garifuna women of Honduras and all that they're doing, and the ways that, yes, now a lot of that is being lifted up, but how much of that has been hidden over these past decades. Black Black women in Brazil, in Colombia, in Argentina, right, in all of these countries in South America who have been a part of or even leading various aspects of the movement for Black liberation, who have been invisibilized in the conversations about what Black liberation movements look like, or even environmental movements, movements around gender identity, sexual orientation, the ways that Black women have been invisibilized. And, you know, thankfully, we're seeing less of that and more clear, visible leadership of Black women and gender expansive people in these movements.
Right. Thank you, Nana. For those who are just joining us, this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and we have a very special Women's History Month roundtable. Today we have three Black women guests, Jamie Swift with Black Women Radicals, Zalika Ibarrarimi, who is with the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, and Nana Jumphy with the Black Alliance for Just Immigration. Now, just going back to you, Jamie, Nana just raised the diaspora and mentioning the struggles, particularly of women in the diaspora. Now, sometimes on our regular roundtable with our regular guests, Dr. Gerald Horn makes the point about a kind of a deal that was made with the U.S., I suppose, and some of the civil rights leaders, not all of them, that one should focus efforts on the situation of Black people in the United States and not get involved with U.S. foreign policy. And we know that there are Black women figures who are internationalists, clearly state that they are internationalists, Angela Davis being one. We know the work of Black Women Radicals. You also, you know, have not only national but the international aspect of it. Tell us how important that is, because when you look at U.S. foreign policies and the way it impacts the global South, not only in the continent, Central and Africa, Latin America, Asia, the Caribbean region, etc., it does seem that those of us who live in the United States of whatever race have some responsibility to pay attention to that and to do what we can to just stop a lot of the slaughter, hunger, poverty, etc. Jamie, your thoughts.
Thank you for that question. I think that's been one of my biggest gripes with some of the present day movement building. And if we are students of the Black radical tradition, we know that Black transnationalism, Pan-African solidarity, whatever people choose to call it, is key to our movements and key to our liberation. One figure who I really truly admire, she was of the Angolan liberation, a leader within the Angolan liberation. She's actually considered the mother of the movement. Her name was Diolinda Rodriguez. And she actually, while in the United States, as a student in Brazil, she penned a letter to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. asking him, what was the best way forward regarding gaining independence from the Portuguese who colonized Angola, Mozambique, and obviously Brazil and other parts of the world. And they had this, he wrote back to her and gave her his thoughts and opinions. And this is a form or an example of solidarity, this transnationalism that is so needed in our movements. We are in the belly of the beast in the United States, right? And so I do think it is our responsibility as Black people living here, not only to be concerned about our plight, but also the plights of others, because it's so interconnected. We saw what happened in Brazil earlier in the year, right? That attempted coup that was so similar to January 6th, right? So fascism, right? These fascist networks can be aligned, but we can't be aligned with those who are enacting liberation or movement building. And I think that's contradictory, and we will not win if this is the case, if we don't practice Black transnationalism or Pan-African solidarity.
And Zalika, your thoughts on it? I mean, can Black people, in fact, anybody in the United States truly be free if, for example, Haiti isn't free or Congo isn't free? Your thoughts on this question?
Absolutely. I think if we're to think, you know, more expansively and more broadly and critically about, you know, some of the oppressions that, you know, people of the African diaspora have experienced, we would have to be diasporic. And I don't mean diasporic in the context of just the United States, as the United States is a part of the diaspora, but more broadly. One of the things that I've seen, especially in the past few years, that has been a concern piece for me is to see, you know, these implementations of, you know, groups such as ADOS, where we think of these projects such as ADOS and, you know, even as another sticking point, as much as I think that it's important to talk about the establishment and slavery in this particular ideation of the Americas, I do think when we are invested in these projects such as 1619, you know, or et cetera, we need to go back and consider those groups who were not just shipped, transported, kidnapped and taken just to the United States. You know, we have to think about, you know, the Caribbean. We have to think about other parts of the world. We would even have to, you know, consider the role of those who are in the UK. And so I think over the years, if we were to really think about it, I reject these notions of a type of ethnocentrism. And I reject these sort of efforts of thinking about Blackness and national frames and within these national borders. I think that it's highly dangerous to think in those ways. And I think in a lot of ways, those forms of nationalism do sort of keep us in a bind to think more Western and think more in fascist ways. So that's another reason why I would have to agree with Jamie that we have to break that mold in centering the United States and think about other groups of people in the work. This is why, once again, I'm really, really happy to share space with you all, because you all are not centering U.S. You're moving the center. So I would have to agree with that.
Right. And we are going to be talking about the movement for reparations and where, as women and Black women in particular, we stand in that. So I'd like you, when we get to that section, to tell us a bit more about Zalika, about ADOS, because not all of our listeners would know that. But Nana, to you on this question, because some people are beginning to use the term global African in reference to Black people, not only in the continent, but throughout the diaspora. But there really is an issue, because we do find, you know, all too often silence when it comes to what is happening to people in Palestine, women, men, and children in Palestine. You have some in the Black political class in the United States that gets support and actually become a mouthpiece for some of the pro-Zionist, and not all, you know, Israelis are Zionists, clearly, but pro-Zionist organizations. And there is that fear that if you speak out about some of these international issues, like what is happening in Palestine, but also in other parts of the world, that there is a price to pay, including your funding drying up when you're running for office. But just comment on that, but the whole question of the importance of broadening our scope from what is happening in the United States to looking at the international scene. Nana.
So, I mean, I think when we think about, or when I think about how I was radicalized and what was part of that, and I would say just a whole generation of people with me, right, that we were working with, that it was an internationalist perspective. So it was, as it has always been, not just something that was not just focused on the United States, or even, you know, as a Ghanaian born in the United States, something just focused on Ghana, what's going on in the continent. And there was almost a clear understanding of the fact that we could not win as Jamie just had alluded to earlier, without also looking at other peoples who are being oppressed across the world. And so when we think about, and that was part of the tradition, right? And so there's a reason that the Panthers would go to Algeria, would go to Tanzania. There's a reason that folks knew to steal away to Cuba. There's, you know, the conversation about Palestine has been part and parcel of the conversation about Black liberation, not just out of movements in this country, but across the globe. And so many of us are really concerned, not just with what we see happening with certain Black leaders here, but on the continent. I mean, you think about the African Union and Zionist Israel's efforts to be a part of the union in terms of those leaders, Netanyahu and others, and, you know, almost making it in, you know, really having to get some countries to rally and remind people that, hey, Palestine and what's happening with Palestinians has always been a part of our struggle. The Palestinians have, on the political end, always supported our Black liberation movement struggles, and we can't forget that. And so I think it's important that we keep that as a part of what our movements are about, and that we continually talk about it. I'm thinking about the anniversary, the 20th anniversary of the war on Iraq, and I'm thinking about how so around the country, Black revolutionaries, and particularly Black women, Black gender expansive folks, how we led and co-organized these the rallies and anti-war protests that happened right in South Central and, you know, Harlem and Brooklyn and all across this country, but also across the world. And understanding not that we were just doing this for the Black Iraqis, right, or the Black folks in Afghanistan, but who exists, but understanding that we were doing this in the tradition of being concerned about war and anti-war in the global context. And then I think lastly, that it is really important for us to remember that the United States is not the center. And particularly as we start to have more connections that are made in official spaces, we were just last year at the inaugural session of the UN Permanent Forum on People of African Descent. And there was a little bit of that, right, where people were like, you know, clutching their pearls in kente cloth because they couldn't believe the Black Canadians were talking and the Black Brazilians were talking. And it's like, yeah, USCN, Black people, you are not the only Black people that have something to say here. You have the money and the passport to get you here, but you're not the only people that have something to say. And so I think it's important that we remind folks and continue to build in ways that make it a part of our, you know, what we do naturally as part of our movement.
Well, thank you, Nana. And all of our panelists are going to stay with us. We're going to take a short station break, and then we return with Jamie, Zalika, and Nana Jumphy. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Yo, this is your brother Speech from the crew Arrested Development. You rocking with KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles.
The late, great Aretha Franklin. This is our one of our Women History Month special. We have a dynamite panel for you. And if you've missed any part of this hour, from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety. And we are on Facebook. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us there. Our handle on Instagram and Twitter at So True Radio. You can check out our website at sotrueradio.org. We're also heard nationwide and worldwide on SoundCloud. Today, I'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the city of brotherly love, as it's called, Jamie, the Philadelphia International. Like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Ghana. And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're having a special roundtable for Women's History Month. Our guest, Jamie Swift, executive director, creator, founder of Black Women Radicals, Zalika Ibarimi, who is with the Malcolm X grassroots movement, Nana Jumphy, who is with Black Alliance for Just Immigration. So, you know, we've been discussing the importance of, as Black women and as Black people generally, of making the case for the international and not just getting stuck on, a particular country. And increasingly, I know there was a conference that happened last year in West Africa where Africans Rising and others were talking about popularizing the term, popularizing the term of that would encompass the entire diaspora, which would be global African. But I do want to go back to something because we are going to have to talk about reparations a bit. Before we get into the divisions of the discussion that's happening now around reparations, I want us to go back a little bit, go back even further in our history of Black women and go back to the role that we played during the slave days as quote unquote, you know, producing and reproducing ourselves, right? And some states in the U.S. that were literally known as breeder states, where after the importation of people, enslaved people was abolished, you had then the push to get as many Black babies as possible being born, who would then become slaves. And places like Texas that were very, very interested in having, you know what I mean, in continuing slavery even after the trade was banned. And I want to get your thoughts on the role that Black women played again during slavery and specifically on reproduction and the impact that should have, if any, on the claim for reparations. Interesting question there. Jamie Swift, your thoughts?
Yes, in keeping with the, you know, our vein of not centering the U.S. regarding enslavement, I would like to acknowledge who I call a Black feminist pioneer, even though this was the term before the term Black feminism. But she was critical in resisting against the Portuguese and also the reproductive violence, right, that happened against enslaved people. And that her name was Dandara dos Palmares. She was the queen of the Palmares region of the Quilombo, right, of a community of formerly enslaved Africans, right, in Brazil. And she and her husband, Zumbi dos Palmares, they led the largest or hosted the largest quilombo of free people in, I believe, the history of Brazil, and actually resisted the Portuguese for decades, right? It also was a space where Black and Indigenous communities who were formerly enslaved were able to thrive. And I mention her because not only was she left out the conversation of her contributions of revolutionary resistance, right? I also found that she was overlooked in the context of aiding formerly enslaved women and creating spaces, socioeconomic and political spaces, right, of freedom, which included safe spaces, against reproductive injustice. And I also feel regarding reparations, I believe just like Zalika, that Black women have been continually left out this conversation. And also where Black women have been left out is how we've been creating spaces, right, that in showcase, excuse me, an intersectionality of our concerns regarding labor and care. There's a scholar by the name of Brea Johnson, who really discusses self-care or care work, excuse me. And those who are predominantly doing care work in our communities are Black women and gender expansive people. This invisibilized labor, right? Particularly Black women and girls being socialized to be at the forefront of caring for others. And I do think that needs to be in conversation regarding reparations, not just the labor aspect in the formal economy, right, where we are deeply undervalued and underpaid, but also that invisibilized labor that we see in the family, in the homes, in other parts of our communities that goes overlooked as well. So that's what I would say about that.
Right. Well, Jamie, very glad to hear you say that. Others may know that a lot of my life's work has in fact been about the recognition and compensation for this care work, which is, as you say, invisible and not compensated. And when it comes to Black women, we know that the poorer we are, the harder you're forced to work. You know, when you're trying to make a dollar out of out of 50 cents, as Tupac would say, and, you know, your mother trying to raise your kids, that is just additional work right there. Zalika, on this point about the consideration of women, Black women in particular, are invisible work, et cetera, in this whole conversation about reparations and also the role that we played during the slave days as well. Your thoughts on whether this should be part of the discussion now on reparations, Zalika?
You know, I do. And I also think, so I belong to the Malcolm X grassroots movement. And one of the things that I've really been thinking a lot about as we've been talking is how I think there's a way, because, you know, a lot of our organizations are U.S. based, that obviously it would make sense to serve those populations of people. But I think what I appreciate about my organization is that we're not trying to be exclusionary. So although we may, center populations of, you know, folk who have been under the hand of colonialism in this country, we will work with those outside of that. So I wanted to first name that. But as an additional point, if we're to think about reparations, and if we are to think about reproductive issues and concerns, because you mentioned that as well, and I think that that's important to tie together, because I think reparations is just not as simple as, oh, you know, you get a this and you get a that. It's more about creating plans, a collective plan for how we can better mobilize folk and how we can kind of work toward our liberation in the broadest of terms. It's not a type of individualized effort, which speaks to how this is not individualized labor. This is collective labor. So when I think of the enslavement period, and I could say it in the context of this country, I could say this in the context of other countries, but at least in the U.S., there was something called partus sequitur ventrum, was just about the legal status of children who were, you know, born under slavery. They would inherit the status of their mother who was enslaved. And I think it's very important for us to really talk about how womanhood in the context under colonialism was not afforded to Black women in those ways. Pre-coloniality, Black women had so many other ways of identifying and, you know, connecting with their personhood. I'm a person that, you know, is kind of indifferent to my womanhood. I may go in and out of it because I am sort of exploring my gender in those ways. But I recognize that, and I think that's important to see how pre-colonially we worked and operated. But I say that as a point to say, in terms of enslavement, if we were to really, really think about the fact that Black women were not afforded that label and instead were just regarded as just bare bones Black females, how much that had a bearing to date on how Black women's issues and gender expansive people's issues are received and understood, which is why I do think that reparations should have a connection to reproduction. So if we were to think about this, I was talking to a comrade of mine named Seneca Joyner. They're an expert on abortion, reproduction, and those concerns. But one of the things that I think is important for us to really think about is not relegating the status of womanhood to just biology or just bodies in that regard, opening up that discussion when we're talking about reproductive health and reproductive issues and reproductive justice. Recently, Seneca was talking to me about how I would say Black trans men are affected in populations such as, you know, Philadelphia, and do need abortion care. But these are discussions that are overlooked literally by the state and the ways that the state tries to define who is woman, try to define who is the terms of who is actually gender expansive. I think if we were to really, really discuss this more holistically, we would see that if we were able to have better and broader conversations about Black womanhood, then gender expansive people would also benefit from the reparations conversation and vice versa. To know that historically we did not have the ability to identify with any sort of a type of gender identity and had to be relegated to a more gender expansive status by way of these biological Western notions of sex, I think would actually help us to have a different conversation moving forward about reparations and reproductive health and justice.
Right. Yeah. We need a whole show discussing some of these issues as the movements generally are struggling with the issues of gender expansiveness. And on the one hand, on the other hand, people not wanting to talk about someone being a mother. And we know that trans people who have given birth have also said, well, I don't have any problem, you know, with that term. But, you know, that's a whole other discussion going there. But before we move the discussion a bit, I'm just looking at the clock here. Zalika, you had also mentioned Eidos earlier. Can you just tell our listeners what that reference is?
Yes. So, you know, ADOS is just an organization. The acronym is ADOS, but it means the American Descendants of Slavery. And it's a type of advocacy foundation, a grassroots organization that is about the sort of something along the lines of American borders. So although I think it is important for folks in the context of the United States to discuss reparations, I think the primary concern, and I don't want to get too deep into it, but the primary concern I think of many people is that it does speak to some of the investments of capitalism. It doesn't really reject these notions of imperialism. So I think I say that to say it would be interesting moving forward as Black people in the context of the United States that we could just be a little bit more expansive in our approaches and realizing that even if you have a focus, I don't think it necessarily necessitates the exclusion of other people outside of the United States in their own fights for reparations, as slavery was a global project and not just a project of the United States.
Right. Thank you for that. Nana, we'll go to you next because, you know, just again, looking at the clock and fast forwarding, looking at the situation of Black women today and of women more broadly, women of color. But you see, we remain at the bottom economically. The wage gap between women and men impacting Black women, the most indigenous and others, has been stuck for the last decade or so. Domestic violence, we see either going up or it's being reported more. A lot of Black women who are being killed, women, of course, killed by the police, but we also see a lot of women being killed in terms of domestic violence as well. The whole issue of femicide is a big one in places like Mexico and other parts of Latin America, not so much so in the United States. So it does seem that given everything that we have been through, given the role of leadership and centrality that Black women have played since the slave days through Jim Crow, through civil rights, through the anti-lynching movements, et cetera, here we are at this place today. And also having to confront not only racism, sexism, transphobia, and the rest of it. Nana, your thoughts in terms of where we are right now?
So, you know, we have to fight them. That's like my theme song. We have to fight them. I mean, we have to, there's a world to be destroyed and a world to be built. And, it's not a coincidence that in all of these movements, as we've described them, that you've described, that women have been at the forefront, but also have been the substance, right? The masses as well of who have been doing the pushing. And I think that we need to do so with a clear understanding that it is these systems of white supremacy, of capitalism, of heteropatriarchy, of, you know, all of that. It's these systems that have us in the position in which we are fighting individually for our very survival. And we need, you know, there's a lot to abolish. There's a lot to deconstruct. And there's a society to build that is more collective, that is looking at, you know, how we center what it is that we need and have people be able to provide the kind of care that produces a society where we don't need police or we don't have war. And I mean, it sounds trite, but actually there was not always prisons. There was not always police. Like, some of these things that we think are so obvious were not things that actually have to exist. And much as people love to think about, you know, these films like Black Panther and Wakanda and who and what, as these fictional things, the reality is that we have a world to build, and it is thoroughly plausible for us to build that world. And it will not be built the way that it needs to be built without Black women and Black gender expansive people. But also, it's not just trust Black women and trust Black gender expansive people. We know that plenty of our folks are upholding all of these systems. And so it's going to be important for us to bring a different way of seeing the world to the table. And, you know, I'm glad to be a part of the group here that's doing that and making that push.
Right. And, you know, Nana, this is such a sharp group here and such a discussion that we're really going to have to bring y'all back together again and explore these issues, because I'm looking at the clock and to you, Jamie, I'm afraid time for last thoughts now from you, and following you would be Zalika. Jamie.
Yes, first of all, thank you again for having me on. I do think that as we see, as Nana said, these increasing attacks, right? We see what's happening in Florida with Ron DeSantis and the attack on African American studies, right? K-12. We see all the attempted coup January 6th. We're seeing all these things now more than ever. It is time for us to organize, even not only a collective, like a Black collective, right? But across race, across gender, across identities, right? To really build this mass movement for liberation. I'm convinced that white supremacists and fascist networks are organized, right? And are willing and ready to push back everything that our ancestors and folks who are contemporary on the ground have achieved. And if we do not work together and show that our humanity and our livelihoods are interconnected, we are, right, going to have a problem. And on the last bit about solidarity, particularly in my case, I do work in Brazil. I think it's time for folks to really look to other people, other Black women and gender expansive people, and connect, right, with folks, right, who are doing critical work around prison abolition and anti-police violence, right, in Brazil. If they house the largest Black population outside of Nigeria, we need to be connecting with our comrades, right, in Brazil, to get strategies, right, and movement building, so that we can expand our frame of reference of Black imaginations and possibilities. And so that's what I will leave with that.
Right. And quickly give us the website where people could find out more about Black Women Radicals. We really didn't even get to talk about all of what you do, but you all are involved in a lot. And of course, Nana Fabaji, I think people know they can go to Black Alliance for Just Immigration website to find out more information. But Jamie, could you give us that website?
Yes, it's blackwomenradicals.com. We also have a school for Black feminist politics, and you can follow us on Instagram at Black Women Radicals.
All right. Thank you. And Zalika, final thoughts from you.
I just also, like Jamie, would like to thank you so much for just inviting me. I think overall what I'm gathering, you know, from Nana and also, you know, Jamie, is that we just have to be expansive overall in our politics, in our logics and our ethics. I think that that's just like a principal way of us moving forward. And I think one of the things that I really, really appreciate about, you know, these, you know, Black women radical figures, shout out to you, Jamie, is that more or less, Black women have taught us how to be more expansive. We've been able to be more expansive in our politics and the ways that we move the work. More expansive in the, our ways that we discuss gender and language and our feminisms. So that's just something that I wanted to kind of end on because I feel like the both of them, they have just said it all. So, yeah.
Right. And just very quickly, can you tell us a bit about the Philadelphia Red and Bright Umbrella Alliance? I think a lot of, well, not a lot, but more of our listeners are familiar with the Malcolm X grassroots movement. But tell us about that Red Umbrella Alliance quickly.
Absolutely. The Red Umbrella Alliance, Philadelphia chapter, is actually an advocacy organization for sex workers and folks who labor in the sexual economy. And, you know, we do a lot of work. We have sister organizations such as Project Safe and also Nightshade, where we do a lot of work situated around harm reduction, political education. But this is just our way of trying to mobilize workers across the city and come together so that we can engage in this fight toward the decriminalization of sex work and the decriminalization of drug use as well.
Right. Well, thank you. On that note, I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there. But as I said, Jamie, Zalika, Nana, we're going to have you back because there's a lot we didn't get to, a lot more that we have to discuss. And I'm really glad that I put you all together in this roundtable. It's really been fascinating. So thank each and every one of you for coming on and thank you for your work. All righty. But we are out of time. So we're going to have to end it there. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank Jose Benavides, who has stepped up to the plate. Alicia Vargas has left us. She has gone on to greener pastures. We hope we wish her all the best in her future endeavors. And Jose, we want to thank you. We also want to thank Gary Baca, our board op for today. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air on Tuesday. I hope you get to do something really nice this weekend, and you all please stay well and safe. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
WBI's next town hall, effective directing of resources for good influence, will be Sunday, March 26th at 4 p.m. You are paying at your pharmacy's cash register, and the screen to confirm your payment asks you whether you want to round up your payment to make a donation to their charity. Answer, no. Why would you want a pharmacy chain with probably too many connections to big pharma corporations and the medical establishment to be directing your money to where they want it to go? Where do you put your money to influence the world for the better? What about sending some of your money and resources to WBAI and Pacifica for the influence it can have on the world? When resources come into WBAI and Pacifica, how can they best be directed within the Pacifica environment? To improve programming, attracting audiences, or to promote good shows already here. This is what's up for discussion. Give us your thoughts. Zoom in by computer or by Zoom. Go to WBAI's Town Hall webpage for the Zoom link information and phone number sign-in information.
The WBAI Community Advisory Board meeting is on Sunday, March 19th at 1 p.m. And you are invited to attend. The CAB, or CAB, is an advisory board which reviews programming and other station policies. It represents the diverse views and interests of the communities WBAI serves. If you want to attend the meeting, you can join by teleconference at 619-309-1058. And the PIN number is 641-711. Everyone is invited to call in and join the meeting, and we're happy that more people are now attending CAB meetings. Once again, the call-in number is 619-309-1058, and the PIN number 641-711. We hope that you'll be able to attend. That's the Community Advisory Board meeting, WBAI, March 19th, Sunday, 1 p.m.